We're highly honored today to have as our speaker Brother David Lawrence McKay, General Superintendent of the Deseret Sunday School Union of the Church. Brother McKay was the first child born to David O. and Emma Ray Riggs McKay, born in Ogden, Utah. He was married in 1928 in the Salt Lake Temple to Mildred Calderwood of Salt Lake City. Brother and Sister McKay are the parents of four daughters, all of whom are married. Brother McKay attended Weber Academy in Ogden and in 1926 graduated from the University of Utah. He holds two law degrees, one from George Washington University and one from Harvard Law School. He has practiced law in Utah since 1936 and is legal consultant at the law firm of McKay and Burton in Salt Lake City. His civic duties include, in addition to being a member of the Salt Lake County Bar Association, vice chairman of the Utah Coordinating Council of Higher Education, and member of the Western Interstate Committee of Higher Education. He's a former member of the Utah State Institute of Fine Arts and has served for the past 4 years as vice president of the Utah Symphony Board. Brother McKay has had a lifetime of service and activity in the church. He filled a mission in the Swiss, German, and British missions from 1920 to 1923 and was associate editor of the Millennial Star. He has held positions of leadership in the Sunday School for many years as teacher, stake superintendent in two stakes, stake board member, member of the Sunday School General Board, and since 1949 has been in the general superintendency of the Sunday School of the Church. On December 2, 1966, Brother McKay was called to be General Sunday School Superintendent, in which position he is presently serving. It's interesting to note that this is the same position his father, President David O. McKay, held at the time he was called to be a general authority of the church. I had the personal pleasure of serving briefly as a member of the Sunday School General Board last year and becoming personally acquainted with Brother McKay. He is a great man. To know him is to love and appreciate him. It is now our pleasure to turn the time to Brother David Lawrence McKay.
It's a little overwhelming to stand here and be here this morning. I appreciate that introduction, President Peterson. It's great to know President Peterson, to have been associated with him on the general board. It's a little like Old Home Week to come down here and see other members of the general board around. I've noticed Dean Wheelwright, Brother Ralph Woodward, Brother Oliver Smith, Brother Evan Davis. I suppose nobody can measure the amount of good these men have already accomplished on the board. They and their associates, other members of the faculty who are also on the board. It's thrilling to be here in this building and this hall named after another member of the general board who, with his talents in languages, literature, and personality, Brother Garrett DeYoung has done so much for the advancement of the Sunday School. Brother Peterson's complimentary introduction was a little different from one I received down in southern United States, where I was on a Sunday School convention with Dr. Henry Eyring. I told the stake superintendent of Sunday schools something about Dr. Eyring's accomplishments in physical chemistry, theoretical chemistry, his awards, I must have overdone it, because his introduction went something like this. We're very happy to have with us today Brother David Lawrence McKay and Brother Henry Eyring, both from Salt Lake City. Brother McKay is the son of President David O. McKay, and Dr. Eyring is an educated man. When the Savior was asked, "What is the great commandment of the law?" he replied, as you remember, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Properly interpreted, these two laws encompass all the other laws of conduct. But I'd like to go beyond those two laws and ask each one of you now to take out his pencil and each one write down what you think, next to these two laws, is the most important principle of the gospel. I'll admit that's an unfair question and a hard one. It's like trying to tell the girl you love what you like best about her. But go ahead and write it down right now. Just one word or two. I'll give you just a second to do that. What you consider the most important principle of the gospel, next to the principles of love of God and love of fellow man, which we've already discussed. Are you ready? How many here wrote honesty or integrity? Isn't that interesting? Very few of you. You may be just as right as not if you wrote something else. Personally, I would put down honesty or integrity. We don't talk very much about it. I'm going to talk about it this morning because just recently we have had two or three accusations, some of them from outside the church, that our Sunday schools are not teaching honesty, are not teaching integrity. Perhaps these criticisms are right, justified. We all assume that honesty is a good thing. It's like motherhood. We're all in favor of it. We accept it. We don't talk about it. If you turn to Elder James E. Talmage's Articles of Faith and turn to the 13th article, "We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent." Honesty is the first principle mentioned in that article. How much does Elder Talmage spend in talking about honesty in his book on the Articles of Faith? Not one word. Probably he assumes, as we all do, that honesty is something that we all have, must necessarily practice. But there is at least one enforcement officer who has come here to Utah from California who claims that when he interviews people who have broken the law or who are accused of having broken the law, he finds that they are much less honest than those people in similar circumstances whom he has picked up in California. Now, whether that has anything to do with our teachings in the Sunday school, I don't know. The Ten Commandments don't say anything about honesty. unless you consider that the commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, includes it. I've heard people say that honesty is not important because it's not included in the Ten Commandments. Let's classify honesty. First, there's the fundamental recognition of property rights. I have an automobile. Someone else does not have an automobile, and he takes it. He's dishonest because he has stolen my automobile. This is the ordinary concept of honesty or dishonesty. When my younger brother, who was barely able to talk or walk, found some eggs which a hen had secreted under the porch of my grandfather's home, he made two mistakes. First of all, he took some eggs which were not his and sold them for some candy at the corner store. And second, he chose eggs which were not fresh. In fact, they were far from fresh. And he got some repercussions, not only from the storekeeper, but also from his parents. I think he learned a principle of honesty that day from actual practice. There is a tendency throughout the nation, among some who would have us overthrow our government, to forget about the principles of ownership of property and to adopt communism. We must fight that as we have never fought anything before. Not long ago, when the poor march went to Washington, some of them claimed that relief is a right. It's a privilege of living on someone else's money, even though one has a right to work, is a right, they claim. I believe that's not honesty. The second principle or classification would be a recognition of personal rights, not just property, but personal. Who steals my purse steals trash, said Iago. 'Tis something, nothing, 'twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed. Certainly no one could say or claim that Iago was an honest man. The third is a failure to pay indebtedness. It's different from a promise to pay. In our contract law today, we combine the two and assume that whenever there's an indebtedness, there has been a promise to pay, either actual or implied. That wasn't always so. This indebtedness can arise without any promise, and as we all know, when we pay painfully our income tax, we have indebtedness there which we did not promise to pay, but which was imposed on us. I don't know why, but so many of us feel that we're just as honest as can be in our dealings with the fellow men, but we don't hesitate at stretching a point here and there when we're making out our income tax returns. Is that honest? A fellow lawyer told me the other day of a man whom he was asked to represent, who made a point of making his church contributions by writing $20 on the check in the middle of the check. After the check had cleared the bank, he took the check and filled in the 200 before the 20 and used that check as evidence of his charitable contributions. Stupid? Of course it was stupid. And of course the government caught up with him. But it typifies what a man who considers himself honest will stoop to do. The fourth is adherence to trust. Not long ago, I was asked to close a purchase of a home. I represented the purchaser, who was to make a substantial down payment for the house, and the deed was to be placed in a bank in escrow to be delivered upon payment of the full purchase price. The lawyer representing the seller, actually he was the seller himself, sent me a fully executed deed signed by him, which I could have, if I hadn't had scruples, could have handed over to my client to be recorded. I'd have got into trouble, of course, but there was no question in his mind that it was all right. These were deals between lawyers. Lawyers trust each other's integrity. They are accustomed to having matters of trust placed in them all the time. I would have done the same thing to him. I would have preferred that he send an unexecuted copy, because I then had the responsibility of seeing that that deed was placed in the bank in escrow, whereas it should have been his. The fifth classification is the actual promise to pay. It's surprising that this large phase of contract law, which we have today, is fairly recent. It was unknown in early Anglican law. It was practically unknown at the time of Henry II and the great controversy between Thomas à Becket and Henry II arose partly because of the claim of Thomas à Becket that a mere promise between two people was sufficient to bring into court, in the church court, whereas the King's Bench claimed that there had to be an actual indebtedness. The fight was not over that alone. It was mainly over who should determine in these gray areas whether the King's Bench should have jurisdiction or the church. Becket, of course, was killed. The King's Bench finally prevailed after centuries. I'd like to dwell a little on this promise to pay, however. Any kind of promise is so essential. I know one woman whom I love very much. All of her children, all four of them who were mentioned today in Brother Peterson's introduction to you, have known all their lives that she never made any kind of promise to be with them that she did not fulfill. Her word to them was a bond, and I'm confident that any honesty that those girls have today results in a large part from the fact that they know that she has always kept her word to them. Honesty is regarded in business as the natural thing, although we hear to the contrary so much. Not long ago, two firms, oil firms, got together. The presidents agreed that they would go 50-50 on the drilling of a very expensive oil well. The matter was turned over to the attorneys. The contracts were intricate, and it required more than a week to to draw those contracts. The well was drilled and turned to be a duster long before the contracts were completed. The company that did not drill the well could have walked off legally without paying anything. The contracts were finished, the contracts were signed, and half the cost of that well were paid. Some time ago, a client of mine came to me and said, "Lawrence, I want to tell you about a bishop of your church." I thought, uh-oh. I've heard of bishops criticized by non-members before. He said, "This bishop had his potatoes in a potato cellar not far from my home in Murtaugh, Idaho. They took up about half the cellar at the rear. A man came to the bishop, we'll call him John Brown, and asked whether he could put his potatoes in the front part. The bishop said, 'Yes, provided you will move them out by February 15th, because that's when I want to sell my potatoes, and I can't get them out if you have yours in front of them.' John Brown said, 'All right,' and he put his potatoes in there. The price of potatoes went up and up and up. February 15th came and went, and the potatoes still stayed in there. John Brown was waiting for the best price. Suddenly, the bottom dropped out of the price. John Brown hurried and sold his potatoes at a loss. Then he went to the bishop and handed him a check. 'Here's the difference between what you would have got for your potatoes on February 15th and what you did get, because I kept my potatoes in front of yours and you couldn't get them out.' The bishop took the check and tore it up. He said, 'I want to tell you that I wouldn't have sold those potatoes. I would have done the same thing you did. I would have kept them for the higher price.' 'Lawrence,' said my client, 'there's an honest man.'" One of our board members, John Boyden, received a letter from his son in the Philippines who told about a young boy who had joined the church. He was attending a Catholic school, private school, and his parents had paid for it up to that time. When his parents heard that he had joined the church, they refused to pay for his schooling anymore. They practically disowned him. There was only one way in which he could possibly continue his education. He happened to be one of the three highest eligible for scholarship in that school. It developed that the other two were non-Catholics also. One was a Mohammedan, one was a Buddhist. When the Catholic fathers heard about this, they passed a rule, or announced a rule, whether it had already been passed or not, I don't know, that only Catholics would be eligible to receive this one-year scholarship. And they called all three of these highest in to interview them. The Mohammedan and the Buddhist immediately became Catholic. The Mormon boy gave his testimony. It was a hard thing for him to do. He had talked with his missionary friend, who realized that this boy was really in a crisis. Tears were streaming down his face. He wondered what he should do. But when crisis came and he met these people, these fathers, he didn't deny his faith. He said, "I can't do it. I believe it's the truth. I'll have to leave." He came the next morning to pick up his belongings and leave. One of the fathers called him in. There was another interview, and he was told that he had been granted a 3-year scholarship in that school. The other two were denied the scholarships. What should we do in the Sunday school and in the home? In the Sunday school, from the negative view, I would say, first of all, let's abolish all junior Sunday school testimony meetings. They're not supposed to be done. I have seen instance after instance in which the children were forced to stand up, either because everybody waited until they stood or because they were told to stand and testify that they knew the gospel was true. They knew, and everybody else knew, that they didn't know that. I think it's a good way of teaching dishonesty. As teachers, we should take care that we don't have a secondary teaching, that we're teaching dishonesty while we're preaching honesty, that we're giving opportunities for the children to sneak behind the back of somebody else and play or write or do something else, and then deny that they're not paying attention. The teachers, of course, must always set the perfect example, and no teacher can afford to preach what he does not practice. One of my daughters came home at one time and said, "Daddy, our lesson today in Sunday school was on the 12th article of faith, obedience to law. And all the time my teacher was talking to me, I thought, you're letting your daughter drive, and she's not old enough to have a license." What kind of lesson was that in Sunday school to that child? As parents, and many of you already are parents, we can follow the example of this mother I told you. Always, under all circumstances, keep our obligations, keep our promises to our children. Second, let us also set the example in the little things. A girl wrote to Ann Landers and said, "Ann, what shall I do? My mother tells me to go to the telephone and say she's not here. She tells me that isn't lying. I'm just doing what she tells me to do. But I think it is lying." What kind of example is that mother setting to her child? Wendell Ashton has written an article which will appear in the September issue of The Instructor. He quotes a business and advertising paper on how to get the young people, how to give them credit. Apparently, the rule followed by the great department stores in the East is this: check first the list of brides, then check their parents' credit rating. If their parents' credit rating is good, give the brides a credit card. That's what businessmen think of the influence of the home on the young person. I pray that our influence in the Sunday school and in the home may be such that whether we preach honesty or not in words, our actions will always make our Sunday school people and our children honest and full of integrity. I do this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.